This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
I need a dollar, dollar, dollar. That's what I need. Hey, hey. Well, I need.
Coming up today, the lost history of 1914. A new book challenges what is commonly taught about the inevitable eruption of World War I and the anatomy of repulsion. Disgust is part instinct, part culture, and powerful enough to incite genocide. We'll walk through its evolution and neurology. But first, in a down economy, most folks are happy to find a crumpled fiver in a jacket pocket or fish out quarters to pay for parking. Not David Wallman. He's a contributing editor at Wired Magazine and author of The End of Money. For the book, David crossed the globe, exploring the deeper meanings and proposed benefits of a cash-free world. He attempted to spend a year without touching or passing any paper money. He explained why.
Well, this was my way of trying to keep the subject matter in the forefront of my mind on a daily basis. And what started to happen is I would watch people fishing coins and notes from their wallets at the coffee shop, or I would eye those huge cash delivery trucks down the street, or I would, you know, see these ATM machines that look like they're straight out of 1982 as far as tech savviness. Mm-hmm. And then I wanted to see, you know, how far have we pushed cash to the periphery of our lives today, and what might this cashless future look like?
And you found that it costs a lot of money to maintain cash, to fund those trucks and to staff those trucks and to, you know, stack money inside of those machines. How much money?
Well, these are colossal figures. No one knows exactly, because a lot of the companies that are behind the cash management infrastructure, you know, they're pretty hush-hush about this, you know, because they make a killing. You know, this was the broader goal of the project, was to subject cash to a little more scrutiny, because for eons it has really skated by without much criticism, you know, in large part because of our psychological bias for the stuff. And we are, from a very young age, really wired to adore this material representation of the idea of money, right? So ever since that first tooth that you lost and you reached under the pillow for a coin, you know, money has an incredible power over our psyches. And so this is one of the reasons, actually, that the idea of finally doing away with cash, even though we've already pushed it so far to the periphery, really infuriates a lot of people.
You travel all around the world. I mean, you're sipping Mai Tais with, you know, a counterfeiter in Hawaii, speaking with, you know, someone as he's doing transactions on his cell phone in India. You visit rural Georgia, where the idea of cash, that kind of emotional attachment, it's almost like an article of faith. Are you worried that model will break down, this kind of faith-based regard for money?
Well, it's one of the deeper questions I wanted to look at with this project is, you know, what is the nature of money? And the whole thing began when a couple of years ago I wrote just a short, cheeky essay for Wired about, hey, you know, our books, our movies, our music are going digital. Why not cash already? Why do we need to keep this technology around? And the response was just thundering, you know, from people of various political and ideological perspectives. You know, how dare you? You know, you'll have to peel it from my cold, dead hands. Mm-hmm. To, you know, you're just a shill for the credit card companies. So this, to me, right away signaled, my goodness, you know, this could be a worthy topic for a book. And why are people so furious about the idea when, in fact, you know, cash is incredibly expensive and arguably most expensive to those who have so little of it. Mm-hmm. And this was really an illuminating thread for me, you know, as someone who's not trained in international development, you know, this notion that cash is the enemy of the poor because it makes them so much more vulnerable to a loss of whatever savings they've been able to accumulate to try and build financial stability in their lives. And much of that comes from being excluded from the formal economy, right? They don't have a bank account or anything like that. So a storm or a flood or a fire or an earthquake, that can trash all of your wealth overnight, let alone, you know, local neighborhood lenders or someone locally who you actually have to pay to safeguard your money, or a drunk uncle or an abusive spouse who steals what little savings you have that you're trying to store up to send your daughter to school 10 months from now. And so these are some of the themes I wanted to look at. And one of the most exciting technologies that I talk about in the book is really trying to use the mobile phone as a way to help people get past this trap, the cash trap, really, and help them enter into the formal economy and build that stability that you and I take for granted, really, in our everyday lives, because banking is just kind of there. We almost forget that it's really a social service. And I'm talking about banking in the very boring sense of it here, right? This is not collateralized debt obligations or Wall Street crooks or white-collar crime or any of that. Banking in the simple sense of helping us build some financial stability, you know, that is good, if not essential. And that's why this mobile money stuff is so exciting and so sexy, really, to development people, because cash really is the enemy of the poor.
We're talking about dollars, cents, and whether they even make sense anymore with David Wolman, author of The End of Money, also a contributing editor at Wired. Well, so, David, you know, one of the things that you talk about is how counterfeiters and the underworld really plays on our addiction to cash, this kind of idea of having cash. If we did away with cash, wouldn't robberies, counterfeiters replace digital versions of the same financial crimes and take advantage of the poor in the same way that they might with paper cash?
Yes, 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 and yes. I think, you know, it would be silly to think that doing away with cash equals doing away with crime, let alone financial crime. You know, the lion's share of financial crime is already electronic. But no one can deny the fact that if you were to outlaw greenbacks tomorrow, you know, the 10,000 bank robberies that happened in America in 2009, 2010, and I'm talking Firmaterra bank robberies, they just wouldn't have happened. There's no incentive, let alone all of the stick-ups at mom-and-pop shops and all other cash-related crimes, from drug dealers to human trafficking, all of it. You just make their business so much harder. You know, and that's because cash is the currency of crime. But absolutely, cash will persist, hacking will persist, problems with credit card fees and privacy, all of that exists. But I actually think that people seem to make this false dichotomy. You know, is it a cash world or a credit card world? And this guy Wolman, he's calling for the credit card world. And, you know, not at all. This book is not a Valentine.
Susie Orman would not do that. You know, she wouldn't tell us to be spending all of putting our money out on credit cards. We actually have to have real cash to back that up, right?
Right, but I think what happens is when you start to scrutinize cash a little bit more and understand its broader costs, both to you because you have to truck to a bank or safety hazards or what have you, and to society at large, if we start to push cash aside, I don't think it will necessarily just be replaced with more of the same electronic payment options, i.e. credit cards, and I don't think it'll necessarily be a boon for them. I think actually it'll make people a little bit more sophisticated in their understanding of how money and how payments work, right, and how where is the friction in our economic lives, and they'll actually turn toward the third, fourth, and fifth payment options that are out there, so that, you know, they're demanding that the private sector come up with more secure options and options that don't charge such high fees to merchants or to consumers.
Well, in addition, I guess, to the sort of abstract and emotional sense of money, passing around cash is really filthy. It's, you know, it's kind of icky.
Well, I appreciate, from one germphobe to another, I appreciate hearing you say that. And, you know, the book, for me, it was a way to explore all of these broader ideas about the nature of money, but through the lens of cash specifically, right? From everything from the amount of germs that it's carrying in this crazy study in Switzerland a couple years ago about trying to grow the influenza virus on the banknotes themselves, you know, all the way to the other end of the spectrum, these much more serious ideas about, you know, how do you bring the 1 billion people out there who have a mobile phone but don't have a bank account? You know, how do you bring them into the formal economy? And what's so enjoyable about the project is that these things are all linked together by this technology that is cash, and the question of whether we've finally come to the twilight of the stuff.
What do you think, though? We're not there yet.
I think we're close. You know, the idea I've been talking about recently is that it's like a death by a thousand cuts situation, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, I'm not going to pretend that I can tell you we're at cut number 892 or 941, but we're definitely getting there, right? I mean, how much of your everyday life now involves cash? I'm guessing not that much, you're a real tax evader and I just don't know it.
And a part-time taxi driver or waitress, I guess.
Exactly. So, and I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, tipping is one of those essential areas where, you know, now this isn't really tongue-in-cheek stuff at all. You know, there are people out there, millions of people, who depend on cash for the lion's share of their income. You know, for the technologists out there, until they can come up with a sufficient alternative or alternatives for tipping people, the bellman, the taxi driver, the waiter, you know, there's no way we should be thinking about getting rid of cash completely. And I'm certainly not someone who's advocating stiffing the 99% here, like prematurely. But, you know, once you start to tell people in the service industry that, in fact, customers tip more when they pay with a credit card, people's sort of reflexive defense for cash, I wouldn't say it ends right there, but, you know, they start to slow down a little once you peel it away at the onion layers a little.
Well, David, I really want to thank you for joining us. A lot to think about today. Appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you.
David Wolman, author of The End of Money and a contributing editor at Wired Magazine. You can read more about his book at our website. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.
Now, what y'all want to do? Wanna be ballers, shot callers, brawlers.
Coming up, fresh looks on the well-trod plot lines of World War I. We'll get some of the lost history of 1914. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Three-course meal, spaghetti, fettuccine, and veal. But still, everything's real in the field. And what you can't have now, leave when you will. But don't knock me for trying to bury 7 zeros over in Rio de Janeiro. Ain't nobody's hero.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. 2 weeks ago, Florence Green, the last known surviving veteran of World War I, died. She'd been a waitress in Britain's Royal Air Force. The story of that war that was to end all wars now lives on in historic accounts, novels, poems, and pictures. Millions of British and American viewers recently got a glimpse of the brutality on PBS's popular Downton Abbey series.
Good news. We're to be relieved today by the Devons. The men can finally get some rest. I've got a few days' leave coming to me.
What will you do with them, sir?
London first. Remind myself what real food tastes like.
The prevailing historical narrative is that the trenches were slaughtering troughs and that the Great War was inevitable, a percolating crisis waiting for a catalyst. Jack Beattie explores new scholarship to offer contrary views in a new book called The Lost History of 1914, The Year the Great War Began. In it, he chronicles some largely forgotten events and players that could have derailed war and argues that trench warfare saved lives. Jack is news analyst for NPR's On Point and author of The Rascal King, The Age of Betrayal, and other books. Jack Beattie, so great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Virginia, it's a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, in school, we learned that the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand of June of 1914 was the spark that ignited war in Europe. You argue against the historical inevitability of it and say it's a doctrine for history without people. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that the idea that there are deep structures that just produce events, and one historian has said of that assassination, if it hadn't been that, it would have been something else. War was just inevitable. That assumes that actions of human beings, even actions, arbitrary actions, even whims, even, you know, fantasies, can't derail history. And of course, we know that's just not true. For example, the Archduke went to Sarajevo partly because the day he was killed, the 28th of June, was the anniversary of his wedding, and because he could give his wife what she never got otherwise, Sophie, first-class treatment. She was always treated as a second-class citizen back home, but on an official trip, she would be treated well. So it was love that got him to go there. I mean, how do you calculate that in any idea of historical inevitability?
Well, you give us some new views of what was going on for the great powers leading up to 1914. Many roiling with domestic tensions. Maybe the best example is in Britain. What was going on there?
Well, Britain was on the verge of civil war, and that's no exaggeration. The issue was Ireland, of course, the damnable question. Specifically, should Ireland have home rule? Should it be ruled from, you know, in local matters from a parliament in Dublin? And to the Protestants in Ulster, the north of Ireland, home rule was Rome rule. They said, we're not going to, you know, live under the Catholic Church. And they raised an army of several hundred thousand people. They were drilling, and they said, if you go ahead to the Liberal government and push home rule forward, pass it in the summer of 1914, we are going to rebel. Meanwhile, the Catholics in the south raised their own army to sort of defend their co-religionists in the north, and you had these two armies ready to fight. And it came down to the last days of July when finally war, it was almost a race between civil war and war in Europe. War in Europe just won. And the Prime Minister Asquith said, thank God, the ways of Providence are mysterious. War has saved us from civil war. Better kill the Hun than one another.
Oh, boy. And the entrenched political powers in Europe, you write about them mistaking democratization for revolution, especially in Germany, let's say. What do you mean by that? What was going on?
Well, what was going on was that every year the Social Democratic Party, the largest party in the Reichstag in Germany, was getting more powerful, and had nearly had a majority. And the establishment in Germany, the Junker aristocrats, the industrialists, the military, feared that the day would come when they would have a majority and through simply democracy change the entire setup to the detriment of the vested interests. And there was fear, there was a sense in Germany, better war than just waiting around and having our whole world set at naught by these socialists. Mm-hmm. And they thought, of course, the socialists were aiming at revolution. Far from it. They were aiming at essentially what Germany has today, a social welfare state. But, of course, to the alarmed right wing of Prussia, it didn't look that way. And some historians think that the Germans actually welcomed the war, sought it to escape from this domestic crisis.
Nearly 100 years after it began, we're talking about World War I with Jack Beatty, news analyst for NPR's On Point and author of several books, most recently The Lost History of 1914, which, unlike the many books that track the path to war, he maps paths leading away from it. Jack, I want to talk to you quickly about France, because you open up a fascinating case that had huge implications for the path the government took that I'd never heard of. If you could unpack it for us quickly, the case of Madame Caillaux.
Madame Caillaux, she was the wife of the finance minister, Joseph Caillaux. In March of 1914, she assassinated the editor, shot dead the editor of Le Figaro, because he was going to publish love letters, she felt, written to her by her husband when they were each married to other people. She said, "This would be an affront to my woman's honor. My daughter would see me in a way no daughter should see her mother." She was tried for this, and the Paris jury acquitted her. The trial came in the last days of July, just as newsboys were yelling, you know, Austria sends Serbia an ultimatum. And if she hadn't killed Calmette, the editor of Figaro, her husband would have been premier. If he had been premier, his whole policy was détente with Germany. And his foreign minister would have been the great socialist Jean Jaurès, whose would be like making Martin Luther King Secretary of State. Mm. He was the great pacifist of the age. And he said clearly in the last days of July, better saving the peace of Europe than honoring our treaty with Russia. And it was the treaty with Russia that compelled France to enter the war. So here's one of the great what-ifs. Her bullets, she shot him five, Calmette five times, really were among the, it was among the most decisive of that year.
If only. And in the estimates of some 60 to 70 million fighting forces mobilized around Europe during the Great War, as the Brits call it, or World War I, more than 9 million killed. But you write that trench warfare actually saved lives.
Yes, the war was at its bloodiest when the armies were out in the open. That's because weaponry had changed, the machine gun specifically. And the trenches were an answer to that. You went underground to save yourself. It's when you raised up and tried to attack that you were slaughtered. So the trenches really represented a victory of life over death. And the brass on both sides feared that this would sap the will to fight. And they went to great lengths to try to activate that will by having trench raids, by making life as miserable as possible in the trenches. But the sides worked out a kind of live and let live procedure between them that allowed them to coexist. And so these trenches were, and the war became bloody again in 1918 when the armies went on the offensive. So it was when they were under that they were safer. When they rose up, They were targets.
So this if only book, if only war was delayed for a month, if only Jaurès would have been in power, what are you doing by challenging this narrative of inevitability about World War I?
Well, I'm trying to show how contingent the war was. I mean, the emphasis by historians has been on all these deep causes, from the psyche to economics to the alliance system. And I'm saying, wait a minute. I mean, there are other factors here. And really, my motto is from Herodotus: very few things happen at the right time, and others do not happen at all. That, I think, is the law of history. that everything is contingency and timing and what happens at the right time or what doesn't happen at all. And I try to show again and again that if only these little events, seemingly small events within the belligerent powers had happened at the right time, there would have been no war then. And if no war then, perhaps no war at all.
Jack Beatty, I want to thank you so much for your impassioned reading of this book today.
Thank you so much.
Look at the crowd up the avenue. Oh, don't you know where they're going to? They're on their merry way to turn night into day.
Jack Beatty, news analyst for NPR's On Point. He's author of several books, including The Rascal King and editor of Colossus, How the Corporation Changed America. We have more on his new book, The Lost History of 1914, The Year the Great War Began, at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, an expert on the psychology of smell unravels the mysterious emotion of disgust. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Don't stay behind, go where you find thousands of dreamy tango dancers.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
For Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Revulsion kept early humans from eating spoiled meat or snuggling up to people covered with oozing sores. Today, some cultures prize cheese writhing with maggots or drink liquor made from fermented saliva. No, this is not a trick to get you to say, ew, but a way to evoke the visceral nature of disgust, which, as Rachel Herz found, is powerful enough to convict suspects, incite genocide, and make us writhe and retch within seconds. Rachel Herz is an instructor at Brown University specializing in the psychology of smell and emotion. She's out with a new book called That's Disgusting, Unraveling the Mysteries of Repulsion, and joins us now from the studios of Rhode Island Public Radio. Rachel, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia. Thank you for having me.
Well, one thing in your bio really jumped up. You served as a smell consultant to multinational companies and expert witness in court cases. My first question is, huh? And secondly, how's this related to disgust?
It isn't really initially related to disgust. It may change now that this book has come out. But in any case, I am reasonably well known in the circuits of those who make smell-based products. That includes anything from fine fragrances to laundry detergent. And also get called in when there is a legal battle where smell is involved. And this can range from anything from someone losing their sense of smell and trying to convince the insurance company it's not the equivalent of losing their little pinky toe, or something more major, which actually does hinge on disgust a little bit. And that is when someone or a group of people are complaining about an environmental odor, when in fact, what I've found when I've been an expert witness in these cases is that there is no odor actually there. And it's just because the emotion the person feels or the group feels towards the facility that they think is producing the smell creates the expectation, as well as usually visual signals like a factory with a smokestack mm-hmm. and that kind of thing.
Well, the strength of emotion here is big. You write that of the six basic emotions of happiness, sadness, anger, fear, and surprise, revulsion is the only one unique to the human species and the only one that has to be learned. So what is going on in the brain when we are disgusted?
First of all, every healthy human has the capacity to become disgusted, but we have to learn to turn that mechanism on. Young children don't show any disgust. The first lesson almost all kids learn is toilet training, and that's when feces first become disgusting, and then other things pile on from there. But children who have been raised in the wild, you know, the so-called feral child, it doesn't seem that they show any disgust even when they're found as adolescents. Although the brain is definitely involved in switching it on, and it has a dedicated area called the anterior insula, it's also really highly dependent on experience and learning and culture.
These are also the areas of the brain that are incited, I guess, or activated with disgust, incidentally also stimulated by lust. What do you make of that?
Well, this part of the brain is actually stimulated by quite a few things. Taste is, in fact, another sensation that's highly stimulated by the anterior insula. If you put quinine on a newborn's tongue, she will make a grimace that looks just like you would look if I said, could you please hold your neighbor's dirty dentures? So other animals have distaste in that they will spit out food that tastes bad, specifically bitter, because bitter is often a signal for poison, and so we shouldn't be consuming it. But in the lust dimension, it's also the case that this part of the brain controls a lot of things having to do with the body. So lust, addiction, empathy, a sense of your own self in place. It's very impulsive. I think Freud would have called it where the id resides, because it's all about sort of wants and needs and hates and stuff like that.
And the registering of disgust is extremely idiosyncratic, as you said. You know, it's different between cultures. But in the extreme, it manifests as OCD. On the other end of the scale, the insensitivity to personal revulsion found in people with Huntington's disease is something you write about. Tell us more about this.
Well, this was, in fact, the little nugget that first got me really fascinated and disgusted, and this was about 15 years ago. A group of patients with a particular neurological disorder had this bizarre inability to recognize what someone making a disgusted face was feeling, and even to really understand why you wouldn't want to be eating a bowl of earthworms. The idea that this group of people have this deficit led to the discovery that in addition to the anterior insula, right next to that is an area of the brain that controls body movements, and that's called the basal ganglia, and that's actually what's degenerating in Huntington's disease. The fact that the basal ganglia is right next door, neurologically speaking, to the insula means that there's this crosstalk and I think cross-degeneration happening, and that's what first led to the discovery that, you know, a specific part of the brain could be pinpointed that's involved with disgust.
We're talking about the mysterious emotion of disgust and what makes people, some people, disgusted, and others, well, in some cases, hungry. Rachel Herz is with us. She's an expert on the psychology of odor and author of the book That's Disgusting, Unraveling the Mysteries of Repulsion. Rachel, our producer, Taylor Quimby, took a walk around our office here to find out what some people find gag-worthy.
When all the dishes are left in the sink and all the food sits at the bottom of the sink and then it keeps piling up, and at the bottom of the sink ends up being this weird gelatinous mixture of food and yogurt and fat. It's disgusting.
Boogers or nose picking disgusts me to no end.
I love my baby. It's a disclaimer. I love my baby. But he is disgusting.
Dirty bathrooms and dirty microwaves.
I think restrooms can get pretty repulsive at times.
Cleaning out the grease trap in a restaurant grill.
People throwing cigarette butts out of the car window. This just happened this morning. Someone driving in the opposite direction of me threw their cigarette butt out, and it actually landed on the car in front of me.
Wet cat food, because it smells nasty, and then the cats hover over their bowl and they just slurp it up.
Yeah, that sounds gross.
A lot of these, Rachel, are something that looks disgusting. So that's a fascinating aspect of disgust. If it looks like it might be disgusting, it must be disgusting.
Yes, and you know, it's interesting because although my expertise is in the sense of smell, smell is really not the primary sense involved with disgust. It really is vision. And you can even get things that are perfectly good, for instance, a piece of chocolate that you would otherwise really want to have, but if it's formed into the shape of a piece of feces, people are instantly repulsed by it and they won't eat it, even though they know that this is delicious chocolate that they would have wanted if it was in a square form. This is because disgust is literally contagious. You can sort of catch other people's disgust. We become disgusted very easily. We're highly suggestible with respect to disgust. I also thought it was interesting that a lot of the comments people made referred to animalistic type behaviors or uncouth behaviors. Mm-hmm. This is because one of the key aspects of disgust is trying to deny our true animal nature, because our true animal nature also belies the unfortunate fact that we, just like other animals, are going to be squished one day and die. And this is really sort of a fundamental feature of the emotion of disgust, our avoidance of death. We have all these codes and rules for behaving like civilized people, and we sort of exalt human behavior. So even in the context of sex, you know, humans make love. They don't have sex like animals do.
But you do write about, you know, the terrible case of manipulating that fear and disgust and turning disgust against other people, specifically in the case of the Rwandan genocide in 1994.
Yeah, it's really a very horrible thing that it's because disgust is so easy to manipulate, it's so psychologically malleable, and it's so powerful and easy to suggest to other people. If you take a group of people and you castigate them as something disgusting, as vermin, as something connected to disease. And in Rwanda, what happened is the Hutus castigated the Tutsis as cockroaches, and they were broadcasting this over the radios, you know, exterminate the cockroaches. Well, first of all, you have two things operating here. One, you've turned a group of people into non-humans, so you've dehumanized them, and then it's easier to think of them as something you can exterminate. And then you've actually turned them into something repulsive that you would want to exterminate. You know, if bugs were filling your home, you'd call the exterminator. So this sort of mirroring of this creature that is vermin that you want to exterminate, you want to abolish, becomes the sort of metaphor for this group of people, and they literally become seen that way. And then it becomes much easier to, in fact, enact behaviors to eradicate them. And this is, you know, certainly you would have people that would, you know, resist this, but it is ridiculously easy to sort of get the suggestibility in there that another group of people are disgusting. I mean, even the way we look at the homeless or drug addicts, our culture has made them very much marginalized and very much on the fringes of disgust.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Rachel Herz, for, I don't know, grossing us out a little bit for, I guess, good purpose.
Well, thank you, Virginia. It was great to be on.
Rachel Herz is an instructor at Brown University specializing in the psychology of smell and emotion. We do have much more on her book, That's Disgusting, at wordofmouthradio.org. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before Jeff Gordon or Danica Patrick became NASCAR superstars, they drove thousands of laps in go-karts. Racing Dreams is a documentary that follows three tweens competing in the WKA, or World Karting Association's National Pavement Series. All three young drivers, Annabeth Barnes, Brandon Warren, and Josh Hobson, have the will and the skill to become pros, depending how they do on the circuit that's been called the Little League of professional racing. Racing Dreams won the Best Documentary Feature at Tribeca Film Festival and made its premiere on PBS's POV series this week. I spoke to filmmaker Marshall Curry earlier about Racing Dreams. He's nominated for an Academy Award this year for the documentary If a Tree Falls, which is also on POV this season. But first, I caught up with Josh Hobson from Birch Run, Michigan. The seven-time national champion of the WKA was 11 when the film was made. Now he's practically a grown-up.
I'm 17 years old, on the verge of turning 18.
So at least you're of legal driving age, I guess, now.
Yes, I finally did receive my driver's license.
Well, congratulations. When did you first know that you wanted to race?
I like to believe that I was born with it in my blood. It's just something that I've always wanted to do. It started out when I was pushing the little Hot Wheel cars around the kitchen floor. But I started racing competitively at 5 years old, and my racing career took off from that point.
Well, here's a little clip of the film. Here you are after winning the first race in the series. This is in North Carolina.
It's probably one of the best feelings I've had in a long time. It was really close to racing, and that's what we came down for.
Well, you sound pretty slick there, Josh, as an 11-year-old. We call that a good sound bite. Where'd you learn to do that?
I love to talk. That's definitely one of my qualities that I have behind me. I like to say that. Talking is definitely one of the things that I love to do, and in the sport of racing, it's extremely important to recognize the people that help you get to the point, especially in the national level. Not too many kids have that opportunity. So it's important that I remember to recognize the people that helped me there. And I guess you could say I picked up a few pointers from some of my heroes in the NASCAR series.
Well, you sound like you are ready for a sponsorship. Has anything happened since the film came out?
The sponsorship battle is by far the most difficult process, especially in the midst of a struggling economy. We've had a little bit more help, and the past year I raced my first full season behind the wheel of a stock car.
Wow.
And so I'm really hoping to add a few more primary and corporate sponsors into this season so I can continue to chase my dream.
It did strike me that you have a sister. We barely see her in the film. I mean, what does she think of all the attention on racing in your family?
My sister is very involved, and she had to make some sacrifices along with myself to keep me involved in the sport. And actually, she was a race car driver during one point in her life. She raced go-karts, and she sacrificed her racing so I could continue.
Wow.
So she's an excellent sister to have, and I love her very much.
What kind of sacrifices do you think you've made to race?
I think the most distinct sacrifice I've had to make is skipping prom every year through high school. So that's probably the most evident one that I can think of.
Racing Dreams is being developed into a feature film by DreamWorks. Who do you want to play you, Josh?
I'm not exactly sure, but I hope it's a very good-looking and attractive young man.
Well, Josh, your wrestling team has a big match today that could advance you to the regional and state, so I want to wish you good luck, and thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Josh Hobson, 7-time national WKA champion, and one of the three drivers followed in the film Racing Dreams by filmmaker Marshall Curry, who's with us from Argo Network in New York City. Marshall, what a spectacular kid. I mean, I can just imagine what it was like following these kids and wondering logistically how you did it. Did you have three different crews?
Well, when we followed them at home, which was a significant part of the movie, it was usually just three of us. So we really wanted to keep the footprint of the production small. Shooting can be kind of intimidating, and so I really do a lot of work to make that less intimidating so that people feel comfortable and you can get some really amazing intimate moments.
Yeah, I mean, you are there in the kitchen while they're fretting over bills, or there's a lot of tension inside of one of the kids' household, Brandon, when his dad, he's sort of in and out of their lives. I wonder how you picked these kids. Did you film a lot more and then narrow it down to them?
No. You know, when I first had the idea for the film, I had been kind of interested in NASCAR, but I'm not wasn't at that point a NASCAR fan. And then one day I read an article about this go-kart series that's like the Little League for NASCAR, where these kids race go-karts that are only 12 horsepower, but they go 70 miles an hour. And this is 11, 12, 13-year-old kids.
Amazing.
So I went to a couple of races to just sort of check it out, and I started asking people if they knew of any racers that I should talk to. Over and over, people said, have you met that Josh Hobson kid? You might want to meet him. And so I found Josh as he was coming off the track, having just won his fourth Grand National race that weekend. And, you know, he's unbelievable. He's like an adult in a child's body. He's smart and he's funny and he's charismatic and an amazing, amazing racer. Brandon and Annabeth, I met some months later, but those were the only three. I didn't want it to be a survey of lots of different kids. I really wanted it to be a deep story about three very special characters. And the racing is an exciting element to the movie, but in my mind, it's really about being 11 and 12 and 13 mm-hmm. and figuring out life and romance and parents. You know, that to me is what elevates it beyond just a kind of human interest story about kids that can race really fast.
And the romance is a part of what develops between Annabeth and Brandon. Let's just say that they like each other. I'm not going to pair them off exactly. Was that a surprise to you when you saw this happen? You must have thought, two of my characters are falling for each other.
It was amazing. A lot of people have said, well, did you have anything to do with that? Did you push them together? And I said, you know, you can't make two 12-year-olds like each other. They like who they like. And so at one point after one of the races where he and Annabeth had been hanging out a lot, Brandon shows us the back of his trophy, and Annabeth had written her phone number on it. He picks up the phone and
Hello?
Gives her a call, and they have this conversation.
Is this Anna?
Shooting that was one of those magical moments where I thought, you just can't write these things.
You know who this is? Who? It rhymes with Randon. Randon.
That's a scene from Racing Dreams, and I'm speaking with the filmmaker Marshall Curry. The film is premiering on POV tonight. tell me about the challenges of shooting something like this. I mean, as you mentioned, you know, you've made inner city stories before and documentaries about the environment, more the thing we think of on PBS.
Well, it's such a big part of American culture, and I think that it's something that a lot of the PBS set or the documentary folks don't know much about. And honestly, I think there are plenty of folks who sort of turn up their nose at racing as if, you know, it's not a legitimate sport. And as I started exploring that world, I came to see that it's clearly a sport. It's incredibly competitive. It's strategic. It's emotional. And the stories of these families trying to get their kids to become professional racers was really amazing and universal. Mm. I mean, Annabeth's father says there are a lot of sacrifices that these kids have to make. They miss birthday parties. They miss, you know, proms. They miss they're constantly traveling. They're constantly working. And that's a sacrifice. But, you know, Mozart made sacrifices. You know, Tiger Woods made sacrifices. Anybody who wants to become professional or great at something has to make sacrifices. And it's a personal choice whether those sacrifices are worth it.
In fact, Annabeth's mom, Tina, she says there's a struggle in her between, you know, the maternal side that says, okay, honey, you lost. And this driving side that says, you know, if you want to be better at this, you have to really stick to it. That's she right. also talks a little bit about the addiction of racing. Here she is. This is Tina.
People don't understand racing because they think, you know, oh, they're just running around in a circle. But, you know, we don't understand, like, baseball. Like, people standing out in the field and one person trying to hit them a ball. What, you know, they might not even hit it to them. So we think that's crazy, you know. Racing is just, it's an addiction. It's definitely an addiction. And, you know, we got it bad. We got it bad.
When I started racing, my mom was like, okay, we're just not going to get big into it. You know, we're just going to see how it's going to turn out and, you know, roll with it. We raced 48 weekends out of 52 this past year. We raced Thanksgiving, 4th of July.
Annabeth Barnes from the film Racing Dreams. We're speaking with the film's director and producer, Marshall Curry.
One of the things I love about that, the Tina Barnes clip that you played, what was so great about it is it just points out that everything's crazy from the outside. I mean, if you watch a baseball game and you don't understand baseball, it's ridiculous. If you listen to jazz music and you don't care about jazz music, it's ridiculous. And that's what I love about documentaries is that they give us an opportunity to go into worlds that we don't understand and hopefully to you know, stretch us and enable us to appreciate the, you know, things that other people love from their perspectives.
And it costs a lot of money. I mean, this addiction. Josh's dad, in fact, guesses it's about $5,000 a race for travel and food and equipment. How do they pay for it?
Well, a lot of it is just coming out of their pockets. So they are constantly making sacrifices. But they're also trying to get sponsors. And that's one of the struggles of racing. You know, if you're a basketball player and you're good, all you need to do is just buy a ball and go down to the park and you can play and people can watch you and say, hey, you're a great basketball player. But if you're a great race car driver, it's really expensive to show somebody that you're a great race car driver. You can be the best driver in the world, and if you're in a go-kart or a car that's not up to, you know, competitive standards, you're going to lose no matter how good of a driver you are.
Racing is probably a sport of pretty low averages for success. I wonder, watching these kids, if, you know, you think, gonna make it, not gonna make it?
It's really hard. And the thing about racing that even makes it more difficult than other sports is that if you're not one of the top race car drivers, you're almost nothing. I mm-hmm. mean, if you are a good basketball player, maybe not NBA basketball player, you can go to college and you can get a scholarship and you can play in college. If you're a good race car driver, but you're not one of the 30-something or 40-something best race car drivers in the world, there's no safety net for you. So it's definitely a hard sport. But the heart has reasons that you can't predict, and people have passions that I guess sometimes they need to chase.
They deftly maneuver and muscle for rank, fuel burning fast on an empty tank. Reckless and wild, they pour through the turns. Their prowess is potent and secretly stern as they speed.
Marshall Curry there, talking about his film Racing Dreams, which premiered this week on PBS's POV series. If you'd like to see a trailer or watch the film online, go to wordofmouthradio.org. In 2005, Marshall was nominated for a Best Documentary Feature for the film Street Fight and is nominated again this year for If a Tree Falls, a story of the Earth Liberation Front. Thanks so much for joining us today for our race to bring you new ideas. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio and online anytime at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Virginia Prescott, and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with oversight and direction
from Abby Goldstein, NHPR's Vice President of Programming,
and web support from Brady Carlson,
and Courtney Kenya.
Andrew Perella gives technical support,
and Dan Colgan. Dan, the man, runs our board.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individual,
not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
Really, anybody else.
For information about the show, to listen to past segments, post a comment, or read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
Or use the On Demand tab on the NHPR app.
You can join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
And you can follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.
The sun has gone down and the moon has come up, and long ago,